I am the children's pastor here at New Hope, and I am honored to be bringing you guys today's message. So, if this is your first time with us, or this is a follow-up to Easter, I want to say thank you guys so much for being here. It's going to be a really awesome week. Now, if you didn't know, we put a pause on our big year-long series called This Is My Bible to go over the Easter message. But this week, we're hopping right back into it. 2 weeks ago, Pastor Rick brought us the message about Ezra and Nehemiah, which in our Bible, it's two books. But it was originally composed as a single scroll, which means naturally today we are going to be talking about the book of Esther. Now, before we hop into the big three divisions that we've been using to break down some of these books, I think it's important that we hit on a very big detail, and that's this. All throughout the book of Esther, God or God's name or God's moving is never directly mentioned. It isn't. And that's interesting, but as we move through the book, two things become very clear. One, the writer clearly believes in God. And two, the writer is pointing us to how God is moving by highlighting that absence. You, as a reader, we look at the events in the book of Esther and we go, oh, God made that happen. Oh, the Lord was there, he did that. And we keep on expecting to read, oh, and God made that happen, and God did this. But it never shows up. The presence of God's hand is blisteringly clear because of its absence in the narrative. And this is something that I don't want us to lose sight of as we go forward, because it's going to be at the core of a couple of the lessons that we talk about. So let's hop into the historical context of Esther. The first thing that we're gonna talk about is authorship. The author of Esther is anonymous, and it's written in the third person, so there's nothing there that would show us directly who the author is, but we can gather some clues. The first clue is this: whoever wrote the book of Esther knew a lot about Persian royal customs and culture and records. The second thing that we know is that whoever wrote the book cared about the deliverance of the Jews. And the third clue is this, that the author had a lot of knowledge about personal events between individual characters. And so it's for those reasons that we traditionally attribute the authorship to Mordecai, one of the characters that we're gonna be spending some time with today. Alternatively, it would have been, at the very least, a contemporary Jewish scholar. Something else that we know about the book of Esther is that it happens between the first and the second wave of Jewish return mentioned in Ezra and Nehemiah. Once again, 2 weeks ago, Pastor Rick brought to us that there were three waves of Jewish return. The first one, Zerubbabel's, and then 57 years later, Ezra's return happened. And so our time frame is between those two returns, which places our story, for our last piece of historical context, that places our story during the rule or the reign of one of two kings, which is either Xerxes or Artaxerxes. Different Bibles will have different names for our kings today. If your Bible went with the original Hebrew, it might say Ahasuerus. You can check it by going to verse 1. It'll be right there. It'll say Ahasuerus if it's based on the original Hebrew. If it's based on the Septuagint, which is the oldest Greek manuscript of the Old Testament, then it will say Artaxerxes. And then if it is based on modern commentary and modern evidence, it will say Xerxes. And interestingly, if this is Xerxes, if Xerxes is the king of our story, this is the same Xerxes who lost so much to the legendary 300 Spartans at Thermopylae. There's no point to me telling you that. I just find it really cool. So... But the reality is that it doesn't matter which king it was, because what we see clearly throughout the whole book is that God was controlling this king for his will. That's gonna be laid out very clearly. So while Ezra and Nehemiah was about the Jews who returned to Jerusalem, Esther is about the Jews who stayed in Persia. So let's hop into the story of Esther itself. The first thing that we're introduced to, chapter 1, is all about setting the stage. And what we see is this huge banquet like the world has never seen before. I mean, it's grandiose, and the whole point of it is for Xerxes to show off his wealth, to show off how great this kingdom has been going. And scholars put forth that the point of this banquet was to rally his princes behind him. He wanted to show that they had the money to fund another war of conquest. And what we learn is that in the last 7 days, that it was an even bigger blowout. He hosted his entire citadel city. Everybody was hanging out, partying, and the women were being hosted by Queen Vashti, the queen of Persia, in the palace. So the men and the women, they're celebrating separately. But verse 10 reveals to us an interesting pattern. Verse 10 shows us that Xerxes was a man that liked to drink, and that was going to cost him very dearly in this moment. This is what verse 10 starts with. On the seventh day, when King Xerxes was in high spirits from wine, he commanded the seven eunuchs who served him, Mehuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, Abagtha, Zithar, and Carcass, to bring before him Queen Vashti, wearing her royal crown in order to display her beauty to the people and nobles, for she was lovely to look at. But when the attendants delivered the king's command, Queen Vashti refused to come. Then the king became furious and burned with anger. You see, some read in this that Vashti was asked to appear in her crown only, and that is why she refused. However, the text doesn't necessarily state that, and we can gather that even without that stipulation, that this would have been an inappropriate request. The men and the women were celebrating separately for a purpose after all. And so the reality is Xerxes was wanting to show off his wife to a bunch of men in his drunkenness, and she refused. Well, the fallout from this is both immediate and it's lasting, because he goes on to listen to his advisor, Memucan, and this is what Memucan says. If it pleases the king, let him issue a royal decree, and let it be written in the laws of Persia and Media, which cannot be repealed, that Vashti is never again to enter the presence of King Xerxes. You see, as a result of this, Xerxes goes on to depose his queen. And it says that not too long after that, Xerxes comes to regret that decision. It says that he remembered Vashti and what she had done and then what he had done. Xerxes is in a state of regret. Oh, but his advisors have this taken care of. Those are his yes men. And they come to him and they say, hey, king, no need for the long face. We've got a plan. How about we put on a bit of a beauty pageant? We'll go and get a bunch of beautiful young virgins. You take your pick. And whoever you like most, that's going to be the next queen. Xerxes likes that idea. And so that's how we're introduced to our likely author, Mordecai, as well as his niece or cousin, Hadassah. And if that name isn't quite as familiar to you, you probably know her by her Persian name, Esther. We're told that Esther is this beautiful young Jewish woman who was raised by Mordecai because she had been an orphan. So Esther is corralled into this lineup of women. And what we're told is the way it worked is that they were given a year's worth of beauty preparations before they went to the king for a night. That was the selection process. Well, Esther hits it off with the king's eunuch, the guy in charge of these women. And he starts giving her different tips and provisions that he wasn't giving to any of the other women. And so it says that in verse 217, that the king was attracted to Esther more than to any of the other women. And she won his favor and approval more than any of the other virgins. So he set a royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. You know, this is actually a common theme that we see throughout the entire book of Esther, is that God moves through the favor of the unwitting. Well, look at who he moved through here. He moved through the pagan king and the eunuch to bring about his will. He's moving in subtle and important ways. And for us, I imagine, it can be pretty similar. Up close, it can be difficult to see what God is specifically doing at times. It can be difficult to see where he's moving until 5, 10 years later, we look back and we go, oh, got it. I see what you were doing there. I understand. It can be a trial or a choice. It could be a hardship. It could just be a curveball that life throws at us sometimes. And then we look back later and we go, I understand what you were doing there. You see, we weren't able to write God's part in the story yet, but he was present. After Esther is made queen, we learn that Mordecai is in the employ of the king at some level. It said that he sat at the king's gate, which likely means that he was either a gate guard or some kind of lower judge who heard the people's grievances. And while he's there, he overhears this assassination plot from two of the gate guards to the king's eunuchs. And he foils this plot by reporting it. He saves the king's life, but nothing comes of it quite yet. He's not rewarded for it yet. And it's at this juncture that I want us to pause and remember what the spirit of this sub-series is. Ordinary people with extraordinary stories. Because that's where things ramp up in that department. We can look at the story of Esther and go, man, this is a great story so far. And you've got this orphaned Jewess who has been made the second most important person in the country. That's pretty great so far. But what we're about to see is how Mordecai's wisdom combined with Esther's character is going to make it so much bigger. Because in chapter 3, we are introduced to our villain Haman. And in traditional readings of this story, listeners would actually yell out over the reader, blotting out Haman's name so that it couldn't be heard again. But what we learn is that Haman is an Agagite who has been raised to be the second in command over all of the princes. And if Agagite sounds familiar, that's because it means he's a descendant of King Agag, the king that the prophet Samuel had brutally killed in 1 Samuel because Saul had wrongly spared him. And so it's because of that Haman might have a real vendetta against the Jewish people. And that comes to a head when he's going out the king's gate one day and he sees Mordecai. And it was the king's decree that whenever you saw Haman, you had to bow down. I mean, this is the second in command after all. But Mordecai doesn't bow. And he makes it known. He goes, well, people ask him, why aren't you bowing down? And he goes, it's because I'm a Jew. He had convictions. And he doesn't bow down to Haman. Well, Haman is infuriated by that. And he makes it his goal to not just destroy Mordecai. He makes it his goal to destroy the whole of the Jewish people. And he goes to Xerxes and he goes, hey, you have this group of people in your land. They're unruly. They're rebellious. They don't really listen to your rules. They kind of need to be dealt with. And so Xerxes gives Haman his signet ring, which is his power to make decrees. And he goes, go and do what you're going to do. So Haman takes that ring and he creates this decree that secures the destruction of the Jewish people. And to determine what day that's going to happen on, it says that Haman had people cast pur for him, which is like our dice, and tuck that away for later. So he determines the day using these pur. When Mordecai hears about this decree, it was a public decree, it says that he put on sackcloth and he mourned at the king's gate. He came right up to the king's gate and he was mourning there publicly. And when Esther heard about what Mordecai was doing, she sends some of her eunuchs with nice new clothes and is like, you put these on, you gotta compose yourself. And he goes, new clothes? Compose myself? My people are about to be destroyed. I can't do that right now. And so he sends back a copy of the decree. Surely she doesn't know about this yet. He sends back the eunuchs with a copy of the decree and asks Esther to intercede to the king on the Jews' behalf. And this is where our story of Mordecai and our story of Queen Esther goes from just a great one to an extraordinary one. Let's first talk about Mordecai. You see, in this moment, as Mordecai calls on Esther to intercede, Esther sends back a message that lays out very clearly what's at stake here. Esther informs Mordecai, all the king's officials and the people of the royal provinces know that for any man or woman who approaches the king in the inner court without being summoned, the king has but one law, that they be put to death unless the king extends the gold scepter to them and spares their lives. But 30 days have passed, this is important, but 30 days have passed since I was called to go to the king. Not only is it illegal to the point of execution to approach the king uninvited, Esther has real reason to think that even as queen, she is not going to be spared. She goes, I haven't been called to him to go in 30 days. She's worried that the relationship is strained, that she's fallen out of favor, and that there's real danger that the gold scepter will not be extended to her. But this is what Mordecai says anyways. Mordecai says, do not think that because you are in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place. But you and your father's family will perish. And then this is a big quote. And who knows but that you have come to your royal position for such a time as this. Have you ever had the thought, you know, I want to do something. I just don't know what to do. Maybe you see something off. You see something awry in your own life or maybe in your family or in your community. And you go, I wonder how that's going to get resolved. Oh, somebody needs to do something, but me, I can't. You know, we can get so fixated on how we're uniquely unqualified to do something that we forget why we were in a position to notice it in the first place. And here's what I mean by that. Here's a perfect example. Esther was so fixated on the fact that she had a strained relationship, that she might have fallen out of favor with the king, that she forgot the fact that she was the one with a relationship to the king. She was the one in a position to do something about it. And it took Mordecai reminding her about that. You see, Mordecai points out that it's likely that Esther is right where she is for a time such as this. In the Jews' time of need, God has put Esther right where she needs to be. Mordecai, despite the book never mentioning God by name, is showing clearly that he is a man of faith. He's trusting God in this moment because look at what he's speculative about. He is speculative about saying, oh, who knows that you've been put in this place for such a time as this. Who knows? But what he's not speculative about is whether or not God's going to deliver. What he says, he doesn't say God might come through. He says relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place. This is a man who has put his trust in the goodness and faithfulness of God, and as a result, is a man that we can take a cue from. And he's not untested here either, because he has done faithfully in his position. He has stood firm in his convictions against Haman, and having been seemingly repaid all of that with the bleakest hour he likely has ever seen or will ever see, he's standing on God's goodness as a guarantee. He trusts God. And it's in that moment that he asks Esther to do the right thing, which brings us to Queen Esther. Let's talk about Queen Esther. You know, we often hear the phrase, live to fight another day. And there is situational wisdom to that. You know, to bow out when the consequences get fatal, to live to fight another part of the war. But sometimes we need to ask ourselves the question, what if we were living to fight this day? What if the battle we were meant to fight was the one ahead of us? Another way that we hear it sometimes is choose your battles, pick your battles. Is this hill worth dying on? Once again, there is wisdom there, but the wisdom of Mordecai here reminds us that there are hills worth dying on. And it's in that moment that we see how Queen Esther responds. We see her outpouring of faith and her answer to the question, is this hill worth dying on? Because this is what she says. Go, gather together all the Jews who are in Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my attendants will fast as you do. When this is done, I will go to the king, even though it is against the law. And then here it is. And if I perish, I perish. Suffice to say that Esther is showing an incredible amount of bravery here, an incredible amount of courage, and an incredible amount of faith. Because we look at this and you go, how do you get that level of resolve to just go into this danger and say, if I perish, I perish? This is the resolve of somebody who's stepping forward in faith, knowing that they are doing the right thing. Once again, it's not that it's undangerous. It's very dangerous. But Esther's doing it anyways. This idea is echoed and it's illustrated in its fulfillment that we have in Jesus Christ with Paul, who in Philippians 1:21, he says, for to me, to live is Christ and to die is gain. For the Christian, or in the context of this Old Testament story, the follower of God, Queen Esther, there is no losing when it comes to stepping out in faith. You see, after the fast, Esther enters into the king's inner court. And it's at this moment that the king could have had her quickly sentenced to death. All the king would have had to do is go, done nothing. He could have said, you know what? No, I'm done. It's time for a new queen. I'm gonna let what happens happen. But God shows up again through the favor of the unwitting. Because it says that the king held out to her the gold scepter that was in his hand. And so she gained her husband's audience. And what she says is, hey, I have this banquet that's going on. Why don't you and Haman come on out to the banquet? And it's gonna be a great time. And so they do. And Xerxes isn't dumb here. Xerxes knows that something's up. Otherwise, Queen Esther would not have risked herself the way she did. And so Xerxes says, hey, Queen Esther, you know, up to half the kingdom, what do you want? What do you really want? Well, what are you after here? And for some reason, Esther decides to delay. She goes, you know what? How about tomorrow, you and Haman again, you show up, I'm gonna put on another great banquet, I'll tell you then. And Xerxes goes, okay. So they go their separate ways, and Xerxes goes home, and that night he is restless, he is sleepless. And Haman goes home, and I bet you Haman was feeling like $1 million that day. I bet you he was going home and he goes, you know what? Queen just threw a banquet, only two guests, me and the king. Haman, you're doing good. You have this big family, you've got all this money, you're second in command. Haman, you've got it all. And on his way out, he looks over and he sees Mordecai. And Mordecai, once again, he doesn't tremble. It doesn't bow, and that infuriates Haman. Haman goes on to say that despite all these things that he has, it's like he has nothing because of Mordecai. What an attitude, right? Well, he goes home, And he erects these gallows or the stake that's 74 feet high. And he purposes to go and ask the king, hey, can we kill this Mordecai guy? He's kind of getting on my nerves. But Haman's a little impatient. He goes back that night. Haman goes back and he wants to ask for permission to kill Mordecai tonight. And when he gets there, like I said, for some reason, the king was restless that night. And as he was trying to fall asleep, he had one of his people read to him the book of the Chronicles, everything that had happened while he was king. And just by chance, I'm sure, they reached the story that noted how Mordecai saved the king's life. And the king looks back and he goes, hey, wait a minute, what did we do for Mordecai? And they go, well, nothing. Nothing was really done for him. He goes, you know what? We should probably take care of that. So he invites Haman in when he sees that he's in the outer court. And he goes, Haman, I got a question for you. What should I do for the man that the king delights to honor? Well, Haman, being Haman, I think he forgot about Mordecai for a second. He goes, he must be talking about me. All right. So for this hypothetical man, king, you know what you should do? You should put them up on a royal horse. You should give this person a royal robe. Have them led around by one of your important princes all throughout the public square on a royal procession. I think that'd be swell. The king goes, you know what? I think you're right. That would be really good. Why don't you go do that for Mordecai right now? And that's where we start to see this ultimate reversal of all the evil that Haman had set about to do. Because the trip that Haman had meant for Mordecai's death became Mordecai's glorification. The next day at the banquet, it says that Esther reveals to Xerxes the evil of Haman. And she goes, hey, by the way, Haman is the one who is trying to destroy my people. Haman is set about to do this evil, and Xerxes is taken aback. This is the second in command. So he goes back outside, and he thinks for a second. And as he comes back in, he sees that Haman is sprawled across the lap of the queen, pleading for his life. But that's not what King Xerxes sees. King Xerxes sees Haman making a move on his wife. And from that moment, Haman's fate is sealed. It says that Haman's head is immediately covered. And then he was later impaled on the gallows that he had built for Mordecai. The signet ring that Haman had is given to Mordecai, and Mordecai is elevated to Haman's former position. And together, Esther and Mordecai work together to bring about the deliverance of the Jews. And the feast that commemorates that deliverance is still celebrated by Jews today. It's called Purim, after the poor that Haman had cast. Because the reality is, while Haman had thought that he was casting poor for the Jews' destruction, he had been casting it for their deliverance. There's a poetic justice there. You know, there's a lot of things that we can take from this story, from the story of Esther. But there's a couple things that I want us to really hone in on as we wrap up here. The first one is this. Do we trust that God is moving in our lives? Do we fully trust that he is going to deliver? As I mentioned earlier, Mordecai and Esther show that they were people of faith based on their actions. You can't look at what they did and go, well, that makes sense, unless you say, oh, they had faith in God. None of what they did or said makes sense outside of the context of their faith. And so the question becomes, can the same be said about us? And I think it's important to know where that faith comes from. Because that faith for them came from trusting fully in the providence of God, trusting that God was in control no matter what. And I guarantee you that we as readers, we look and we go, oh, God was there, God was there, God was there. But it wasn't quite as clear for them in the moment. Each step for them was a step of faith. And so the encouragement there is knowing that when we step forward in faith, God is gonna be with us. Here's the other idea is, yes, where you're stepping forward, but the next question is, what are we stepping forward into? What are we stepping forward into? I wanna ask you a question. Are you where you are? Better yet, are we where we are for a time such as this? Because it applies to everybody. Are we where we are for a time such as this? When I mentioned earlier, you know, maybe you see something off in your community or your family or maybe just your life, and you know something needs to be done about it, but you go, I can't do anything about that. And sometimes we have Mordecais who come along and spur us into action, and that's an awesome thing, but we don't always have that luxury. And so I want to take a chance and be that Mordecai for you in this time and ask you, are you where you are for a time such as this? That thing that needs changing, is that us? Is that you? Can you make that change? And if, as you process that, if the answer you're thinking of is, yeah, I think that is me. I think I can make a change there. Here's what I want to encourage you with. Is that a step taken in faith is never a step taken in vain. God is with us. See, Mordecai's trust that things would pan out, and Esther's willingness to risk her neck for all her people, these are things that don't make sense outside of faith. These are two people who were brought from being just ordinary people, but they were brought into an extraordinary story because of that faith. And as we close on that, on this sub-series, that's the reminder that God can and will use anybody for his will. And the only question that we need to ask to step into that same thing, the only question that we need to answer to have that extraordinary calling is this: do we believe and trust that he can do it again? Let's pray. Father, thank you for the incredible example of Esther and Mordecai. Thank you for working in their lives to bring about deliverance for your people. I pray for wisdom in this time ahead as we process this message, that you would give us knowledge of who you are and draw us closer to you, God. And I pray that we would trust you, that in this time ahead that we would internalize what it means to trust you with everything and we would follow suit. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you, guys.
Hello, thank you so much for tuning in to New Hope this week. You know, the church doesn't stop when the video does. And make sure that you share this with a friend. You can even support what we're doing via the Give button here on the left. You can also subscribe to our YouTube channel so you don't miss a single Sunday. And we cannot wait to see you this week, either in person or online. Have a great day.